Hello again, everyone. We're feeling the heat out here in California. Welcome to another edition of KHOI Community Radio's Capital Week, where we talk politics, Iowa style, and explore and analyze who's been making news in and around the state capital, what that news is, and what it all means. I'm Dennis Hart, and as always, my partner in politics, Laura Bellin of the blog site Bleeding Heartland, is alongside. This time, as I suggested, I'm in California, you're in Iowa. It is good to be with you again, Laura.
Yes, good to be here.
Well, from across the country, let's talk about the major things that went on in Iowa last week. And a big one, the John Deere strike. The Deere Company and the United Auto Workers agreed to a third potential contract late Friday night. The two sides reached an agreement that includes what's called modest modifications over the most recently rejected contract offer. UAW members will vote on it on Wednesday. Laura, what are you hearing about the new contract offer and the possibility of it being accepted?
Well, first of all, just to remind people, the last time that they voted on a tentative agreement, it failed by about 55% to 45%. It was fairly close, and the company only needs to win over about 500 people to get this tentative agreement accepted. The modifications are very minor. They affect some workers are not affected by them at all. It's a very complicated formula for a certain type of benefit that some workers get. But I think that what is going to determine whether this passes or not is not these very slight increases in the benefits for some workers, but just a sense among the workforce, do the UAW members believe that they have enough leverage to get a significantly better offer if they hold out for longer? As we've talked about before, they're getting $275 a week for strike pay. That's a lot less than they would normally be getting on the job. And so if the John Deere has said this is our last best offer, and if the workers don't think that they can get something better, then they might think there's no purpose holding out for another month or two or three. Remember, the last John Deere strike in the 1980s lasted for a little more than 5 months. That's an awfully long time for people to be without a regular paycheck.
The last contract that they turned down a couple of weeks ago offered a 10% immediate wage increase, 5% over the following two of the three next years, 2023 and 2025. Lots of folks were surprised that that one went down, and it went down because the two biggest locals in Waterloo and Dubuque overwhelmingly rejected it while the others accepted it. Is there any word on why those locals said no, why they turned thumbs down on that?
No, I really haven't heard. And the UAW is discouraging individuals from talking to the media. So they're trying to keep the information flow fairly tightly controlled. So it's hard to get a sense of what it was exactly that the people in the Waterloo and Dubuque locals didn't like about that contract. Again, it could be just a matter of people who were speaking at the meetings the unions were holding, just a gamble about having more leverage. I mean, I remember seeing some people post on social media who worked at the Dubuque plant that they felt it was a good offer, but they just thought that they could get something better if they hold out a little longer because the company is going to be under pressure to get production going again. I mean, that's the big question that nobody really knows is how long can Deere go on and fill all the orders that it has without having the regular production line working. I mean, it's just not realistic that they would be able to produce the machinery that they do with having their salaried workers on the line. So, but some people say that they have quite a bit of inventory stockpiled, and so they could wait out the UAW for a while longer. And I think that's just, there are a lot of unknowns related to that.
Right. And one of the things that plays out here is that one would expect that Deere's competitors would have an advantage right now in terms of manufacturing things or getting things out, but they're facing the same problems in getting materials that Deere would be facing if they were manufacturing. In other words, everything's blockaded for a variety of reasons in the United States, the coronavirus, blockades on shipments, et cetera. So Deere's competitors may not be in quite the good position that one would think they might be at this point.
Yes. And the people in the UAW who voted no believe that this is the timing is great for them because of the labor shortage that's related to the pandemic and other factors, that they feel that this is the best time that they can really hold out for a better offer from the company, that Deere's profits went up substantially during the pandemic, and they just think that the company can give a little more. Of course, the Deere has been taking out advertising on social media. They've run full page ads in the Des Moines Register and Quad City Times and other newspapers to say, what a great offer. These are benefits that we're giving that most people in our industry don't provide. And so they're really trying to win over again. They just have to sway about a few hundred people and persuade them that this is the best deal they're going to get. So I don't know that, I certainly wouldn't want to make a prediction about how this vote is going to go on Wednesday. I think it could be very close.
Meanwhile, the Des Moines Register published a poll showing that most Iowans support the UAW in their strike at Deere, a significant majority. Is this a surprise to you?
I wasn't very surprised. And here's why. The Republican Party, there are more and more people who consider themselves working class are identifying as Republicans. And I think that's what you really saw in this poll. The overall numbers were very strong in saying that they side with the workers rather than the company. But even among the Republicans in the sample, that was the overall number is 58% mostly side with the workers, only 16% mostly side with the employers. And if you look at just the numbers for Republicans in the poll, it was about 49% support the workers and about 24% support the company. And so this is not your country club Republican Party that you might think. So I think that a lot of people understand that wages haven't increased, real wages, that is, when adjusted for inflation. Real wages haven't increased much for decades, and the company is doing very well. And so I think that a lot of people have sympathy for the idea that the company should share the wealth a little bit more with the people who are on the line who actually make these machines that create the profits for the company.
To recapitulate, the strike has been going on since October 14th, and we know it's getting cold in Iowa, going to get colder. I wonder how much both of those factors are going to play in to the strike vote on Wednesday, because at some point, do workers get tired of being out in the cold? Do they get tired of the $275 a week because it's tough to live on that? It's impossible almost to predict that, but one has to think about that, I think.
Yes, and with the holiday season coming up, I mean, a lot of people have extra expenses during that time. And so, again, I think that that's the changes, the modifications to this tentative agreement were so minor. I think the real question is not whether this deal is so much better for workers financially, but do they believe that by holding out, they could get a better deal? And I think, I mean, there may be, as you say, a sense of fatigue and not wanting to be out in the cold. On the other hand, I did see somebody posted some pictures from the UAW local hall in Ankeny, and they have like a food pantry and tables out with some essentials, toiletries, diapers, things like that. People have been bringing in donations. And the person who posted this said that she asked people with the union, how is it going? And they said these tables have not been empty at all at any day during this whole strike. So they feel that they still have a lot of community support. People are bringing in items to help the workers who are not getting their regular pay. And so that may bolster the feeling among some people that they want to hold out a little bit longer. Because again, the next time they have a contract negotiation, they might not be in as strong a position. There might not be a workforce shortage, and so on.
This is a big strike. Nation is looking at this, and they will be voting on Wednesday, and we'll be talking about this on Monday on Capital Week. So come on back and join us. Another Register poll came out yesterday. This one, I'm talking Sunday now, this one pitting President Biden against a possible opponent in the 2024 election. Now that possible opponent is Donald Trump. And the poll showed that if the election were held today, and it is not, but if the election were held today, Trump would easily defeat Biden in Iowa again. No surprise here.
Mm-hmm. Not surprising. I mean, Biden's approval numbers in Iowa have been bad. This is now the second poll in a row that his approval has been very low. I think it ticked up by a couple of points, but the president's approval is in the 30s. So for the fact that he got 40% in this head-to-head against Trump, it was interesting. That's actually higher than his current approval number in the same poll. So Trump, he carried Iowa in 2016 by about 9 percentage points. He carried Iowa in 2020 by about 8 percentage points. And this poll has him leading Biden by about 11 percentage points. So it's kind of on track with where we think the Iowa electorate is. And again, as we've seen in some of the recent elections, it's the independents in Iowa that are skewing to the Republicans. Biden's support among Democrats is still very strong. He's holding his own there, but it's the independents who are favoring Trump in this poll.
Right. And there will be more Des Moines Register polls this week that we'll be telling you about next Monday. Meanwhile, last week, a big announcement by Cindy Axne, the Iowa Democratic 3rd Congressional District incumbent. She had been teasing us all year about, am I going to run for governor? Am I running for re-election? Well, she decided.
Yes, I think she was mainly waiting to see what the map looked like. And I don't think that anyone really expected her to run for governor. I mean, for some perspective, Donald Trump carried the 3rd Congressional District just barely by less than half a percentage point, whereas he carried the state by 8 points. So to run in a statewide election, that's going to be a much heavier lift than to run for re-election in a district that's basically a toss-up. And the new map, although it does shift the counties, Cindy Axne picks up about 8 counties she didn't represent before, and she loses some counties in southwest Iowa. The bulk of her district remains the same. About 75% of the population lives in Polk County or Dallas County. Those are the far west suburbs of Des Moines and Dallas County. And so this is a district that, even in a tough environment for Democrats, this is a district where she has a very realistic chance of getting reelected. I just saw that Inside Elections today, they released their first set of ratings for the congressional races in Iowa, and they consider this 3rd district race to be a toss-up.
Really? Who does she face potentially?
Well, there are at least 4 Republicans who have said they're running. The one who has the support among the Washington, D.C. Republicans is State Senator Zach Nunn. He's been in the legislature since 2014. He has served in the Air Force and worked in Washington, formerly worked on Chuck Grassley's staff. And he is kind of a classic, I would say, establishment Republican. He's trying to reinvent himself a little bit on his social media as a Trumper, but he was a Jeb Bush endorser in 2015. So he's really not a Donald Trump type of Republican. But he has the support of the National Republican Congressional Committee. That's the arm of the U.S. House Republicans in Washington. Then there are 2 other candidates who I think could get some traction in the primary. One is named Nicole Hasso. Most people had not heard of her. I had not heard of her until she declared that she was running in the summer, but she was endorsed by Senator Ted Cruz. And she raised some money from some pretty big names, including, for instance, Joni Ernst, former state director here, gave the maximum contribution to Nicole Hasso. So she's running as a little bit more of an outsider candidate. And then there's a guy named Gary Loeffler, who most people probably haven't heard of Gary Loeffler, but they've probably seen pictures of him because he is regularly at Republican events all over the state, driving a Trump tractor, a tractor that's very heavily decorated with Trump signs. He was in Washington, D.C. on January 6th. He was at a number of the so-called Stop the Steal rallies in Des Moines and elsewhere after the election. And so he's running as like an uncompromising Trump Republican. There's a 4th candidate, Marianne Hinojosa, who's from Council Bluffs. She formerly served in the Iowa House. And even though Council Bluffs and Pottawatomie County are not part of the district anymore, she's saying that she's still planning to pursue this campaign, and she's not dropping out yet. But I don't really see how she could possibly be a factor in this primary, since she's not well known anyway in the district. And now her home county, where she is relatively well known, is not part of the district. So really 3 candidates who I think have some potential in the primary, but Zach Nunn has to be considered the front runner, I think.
And do you expect anybody else to jump in on the Republican side?
I have not heard of anyone else. And it's possible that somebody would, but I think that so far, Gary Loeffler has a lot of support among the rank and file activists and in some of the evangelical churches. And Nicole Hasso, I think that Ted Cruz endorsement really helped her over the summer gain some name ID. And so I think it would be difficult for somebody else to come in. I don't really know what niche there is that another Republican could come in this primary. I don't expect anyone who's like an establishment Republican to join, because Zach Nunn already has the endorsement of the National Republican Congressional Committee.
Cindy Axne's news came just days after Iowa Republican Congresswoman Marionette Miller-Meeks announced she's going to run for re-election in the newly redrawn 1st Congressional District. So she's running in the 1st. What kind of race is she facing?
It's going to be very competitive. I think the overall environment, if it's true that this midterm election favors the party out of power in Washington, then she'll have the wind at her back, and that's going to help. But the district is very competitive. This is It covers most of Southeast Iowa. It stops before, just before her home county, Wapello, which is where Ottumwa is. So she loses eight counties along the southern two tiers of Iowa that she's represented. But she picks up that the population centers of her district are Quad Cities, Iowa City, and then some of those mid-sized cities along the Mississippi River. So Muscatine, Burlington, Keokuk. Those are where the bulk of the population lives. And her district where she won by six votes in 2020, that was a district that Donald Trump carried by about 4 points. This new district, Trump carried by only about 2 points. So it's really almost a toss-up district, but given that she has the incumbency advantage now and that as this midterm election is shaping up to be fairly good for Republicans, I think that I would say that's probably a lean Republican race. The leading Democratic candidate right now is Christina Bohannon, who's a law professor at the University of Iowa and also a state representative from Iowa City. She's a great candidate. She's a great speaker. And so she potentially could get some traction, but I just think it may be hard for any Democrat running against a Republican incumbent, especially if Biden's approval numbers remain the way they are.
It is 15 and a half after the hour, wherever you are listening to us. And you're in tune with KHOI Radio's Capital Week. I'm Dennis Hart with Laura Bellin. We're here every week at this time to talk about politics, Iowa style, and how it's affecting all of us. Let's go down the list. The House 2nd District in Iowa, Republican incumbent Ashley Hinson is going to run. This gets confusing, but because of redistricting, she's now in the 1st District, but she's going to run in the 2nd, and she's going to have a heck of a race, isn't she?
Yes, I think so. Her district remained largely the same. That Cedar Rapids is the largest city. She also represents the Waterloo-Cedar Falls area in Dubuque. She picked up Mason City. So that's a somewhat Democratic-leaning area that became part of her district. But she also picked up some Republican-leaning counties in north central Iowa. So overall, that's a district that Donald Trump carried by a few points. And the Democrats have a very strong candidate in State Senator Liz Mathis. She was a nightly news anchor in the Cedar Rapids market for many years. Ashley Hinson was also working on local television in the Cedar Rapids market. She did mostly worked on morning programs, which don't have quite the viewership of the evening programs. But Liz Mathis is really working hard already, traveling a lot around the district. And again, I think partly it's going to depend on what the overall national atmosphere is. So that I think most people looking at that race right now would say maybe it leans Republican, but it's certainly a winnable district for the Democrats, especially with a candidate as strong as Liz Mathis.
And Laura, I just want you to know I anchored on television in both the morning newscast and evening newscast. And the evening newscasts were much preferable because I got to sleep in later.
Yes.
In the 4th District House in Iowa, GOP incumbent Randy Feenstra expected to run for re-election and honestly not expected to have a lot of trouble, is he?
No, I mean, the only potential trouble he could have would be in the Republican primary. I still have not heard who might be thinking about running, but one of the conservative bloggers, Jacob Hall, he says that there is someone up in Northwest Iowa who's thinking about running against Randy Feenstra. I can't really imagine that he would lose a Republican primary. It's pretty difficult to beat an incumbent in the primary. I mean, even though Feenstra beat Steve King, most people who challenge incumbents do not win or even come close to winning. And usually the incumbent has to have some kind of major scandal or huge baggage like Steve King did. So I just think it would be hard. I mean, there are people who are upset because Randy Feenstra voted to certify the Electoral College vote, but he's basically been a down-the-line party vote. He hasn't crossed over to vote with Democrats on any significant legislation at all. He didn't vote for this bipartisan infrastructure bill. None of Iowa's Republicans in the U.S. House did. So I don't really think he's vulnerable in the primary. I haven't heard about any Democrats running against him in the general. It's just that district is not really winnable for a Democrat in the general election.
And one more note on the election before we move on. The West Burlington School District, this is one of those oddities, learned who's going to serve in the vacant at-large seat last week for the next couple of years. And the winner was a write-in candidate named Vanessa Johnson, whose name was pulled from a bucket during the Des Moines County Board of Supervisors meeting last Monday because she and another person had tied for the seat, the same number of votes. Not a lot of votes. Each of them got six votes. So they tied and the name was picked out of a bucket. And this isn't, it's unusual, but it happens sometimes, doesn't it, Iowa? This is not one of those once in a lifetime things.
Oh, no, not at all. It seems like almost every local election cycle, there's some city council or mayoral race somewhere that's a tie. I mean, I hear about that fairly regularly. It's not a common occurrence, but it is right there in the code that it's that the names are drawn out of a hat. By the way, most states have something similar in their election law. And apparently in Nevada, in that situation, they draw from a deck of cards.
Well, our congratulations to Vanessa Johnson, who got a name pulled out of a bucket. I don't know how big the bucket was, but she won it. All right, let's go on to the coronavirus. And the numbers, boy, unfortunately, again, are not good today. And they have not been good for a number of weeks. It's going in one direction, and that's up again. Iowa continued its upward trend with 8,427 new cases reported in the last 7 days on this Monday. That's up 400 from reported on Friday. More than 500,000 Iowans have been tested positive for the disease since the pandemic started. Hospitalizations are going up. The positivity rate's going up. Laura, the news is just not good about the virus in Iowa.
It's not. And as we've discussed before, I look a little bit skeptically at the case numbers because I never know whether we're really testing enough. Typically, when the positivity rate is going up, that means that you're not testing enough people. So we don't really know how many new cases there are. But the hospitalization numbers, those are not something that are as subject to, that they're not as subjective. And so it's a very bad sign if the hospitalization numbers are going up. And I just want to say that the epidemiologists and infectious disease people I follow on Twitter are very concerned by what's happening in several European countries, including countries that have much higher vaccination rates than the United States. They're seeing cases go way up in Germany, in the Netherlands, in Austria. And so it's not really clear what's going on, whether this is another variant or another mutation of the Delta variant, or whether it's just waning immunity from people who were vaccinated more than 6 months ago. They're not really sure what's happening, but there's a lot of concern because if we get the same kind of wave they're having in Europe with our lower vaccination rates here, we're going to have a lot of hospitalizations and deaths. And so it's very concerning to people. And I'm still hearing stories anecdotally about people. Somebody just told me that either her father or father-in-law has a septic infection, is in the hospital in Newton. Normally they would transfer him to an ICU in Des Moines, and there are no ICU beds.
Right. And that is happening here in the Central Valley of California, where one hospital had to turn away 51 people on one day last week because there were no beds available. They were taken up by coronavirus patients.
Yes. And again, the COVID patients who end up in the ICU tend to stay for a long time. Many of them stay for weeks. And so it's different. A typical people who have worked in ICUs will tell you that a lot of people land in the ICU for a few days following, let's say, open heart surgery, or they break a hip. They're there for a short time, and then they move into a different wing of the hospital or a rehab place, whereas these COVID patients are taking up a bed for weeks. And so it's very difficult to turn the ship around and start bringing those hospitalization numbers down.
And many of those hospitalized, and this is the case all across the United States, are living in rural areas, and or they are Republicans.
Yes, because the vaccination rate is so much lower, and that's just the disparity is just increasing. The more people are measuring it, there is just more of a difference in the hospitalization and the death rate. I will say that there are some people who are hospitalized who were vaccinated, and typically those are people who are older or have underlying conditions that suppress their immune system. So, for instance, they might have an organ transplant, or they might have multiple sclerosis. If you remember Colin Powell, who passed away a few weeks ago, he had multiple myeloma that interferes with your immune system. So some people who are vaccinated don't build up as robust an immune response, and they can end up in the hospital. But we're still seeing the overwhelming majority of hospitalized people are the unvaccinated.
Right. And as all this was going on, there was word that Iowa has joined a coalition of 10 states challenging a new rule by President Biden's administration requiring millions of healthcare workers to be vaccinated against the coronavirus. This is completely consistent with Governor Reynolds' mantra that the federal government is overreaching on everything involving the coronavirus, and she wants to block it in Iowa.
Yeah, so that's the third federal multi-state lawsuit that the governor has signed on to that's challenging different aspects of the Biden administration's vaccine policy. And I mean, one thing that when an angle that hasn't been emphasized a lot, and the governor hasn't had a lot of press conferences lately, is that Iowa is having a lot more nursing home outbreaks, I think because are largely because unvaccinated staff or visitors are bringing the virus in. And then even many of the residents, even if they are vaccinated, they still might be vulnerable because of their immune response, just either because of their age or other health conditions that they may have. And so what we're not hearing from the governor is pleas to the nursing home workers to please get vaccinated to try to reduce the spread and bring the case numbers down in the nursing homes. Instead, the message is all about, I support the right for people to remain unvaccinated. And so I think it's very different from even 6 months ago, 8 months ago, where the governor at least was publicly talking and encouraging people to get vaccinated. It's really been a while since we heard her out there saying, I need people to step up and get vaccinated.
And she is not urging parents to get their young children vaccinated. She is saying, talk to your pediatrician.
Yes, that's different as well, because she, in the late winter and early spring, when the vaccines were becoming widely available, the governor was encouraging everyone. She got vaccinated herself on live television at one of her press conferences. And this is very different when they lowered the age to the 5 to 11-year-olds. And I don't recall the governor ever saying that 12 to 15-year-olds should get vaccinated either. I don't recall any big push to get those teenagers vaccinated. So, yes, she's been telling people that they should talk to the pediatrician. So I think that there's the Republican politicians realize, even though many of them are vaccinated themselves, they realize that the base of the Republican Party includes the majority of the people who are determined to stay unvaccinated, and they don't want to upset those people.
Right. Couple of quickies in the last 3.5 minutes here. Iowa stands to gain about $5 billion in new roads and bridges, broadband and water infrastructure, following the approval by the U.S. House of Representatives and the signing of by President Biden of that sweeping infrastructure bill. Now, the bill was supported in Iowa only by Republican U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley in the Senate and by Democratic 3rd Congressional District Representative Cindy Axne. Every other Republican who had a vote voted against it, even though that money is coming to Iowa.
Yes. And it was funny. I noticed today Cindy Axne was at the signing ceremony. She was tweeting pictures of herself at the signing ceremony. She really wants to get the word out about this bill as much as possible. Senator Grassley, although he did vote for the bill, he's been a little bit quiet about it, and he didn't show up. A few of the Republican senators did show up at the signing ceremony. The president invited them all. I noticed that the statements from the House Republicans in Iowa who voted against the bill, Ashley Hinson and Marionette Miller-Meeks and Randy Feenstra, they talked about how we need a clean infrastructure bill that's focused on real infrastructure like roads and bridges. And of course, that is what the bulk of this bill had. I mean, $3.4 billion of Iowa's $5 billion is going to be in highway funds and another $432 million for bridge replacement and repair. So that right there is the bulk of the $5 billion that we're getting. Also, $638 million for water infrastructure in Iowa, about $305 million for public transportation in Iowa, $120 million for airports, and about $100 million for broadband. And by the way, sometimes people think public transportation is only for large metro areas, and why would Iowa need public transportation? But there's a lot of need for public transit in Iowa. Like, for instance, people who may live in a small town, but they need to go see the doctor or do shopping or other essential things in a slightly larger city like a Fort Dodge or a Marshalltown in Boone, there can be public funded bus services that take people from very small towns to the mid-sized cities. So that's the kind of thing, the public transportation, it's not just for the larger cities like Ames and Des Moines.
A little bit more than 1 minute to go. Charles Palmer died last week. He was 82 years old. He was very important to Iowa. Why don't you talk about that, Laura?
Yes, he served for a long time under Governor Branstad. He ran the State Department of Human Services, which is the largest state government agency. It's a huge agency, and it's a very difficult job. He did that in the 90s, and he came back. He was already over 70 years old, but he came back in 2011 and ran that department again for another 6 years. So he's someone who really, I mean, that department, it runs the Medicaid program, it runs a lot of inpatient facilities, and it's just a huge part of state government.
Yep. Well, coming up this week, what we know about anyway at this moment in the last 30 seconds, the vote on the John Deere strike, and that is a very big deal indeed.
Yes, and I'm also watching every day more legislative candidates around the state are announcing their plans, and so I'm continuing to track that as well.
And you will be reporting on that here next week, as well as on your blog site, Bleeding Heartland. And I do believe you never sleep when you're writing that blog. Is that correct?
Rarely. I need less sleep than the average person.
Well, yes. And you never fall asleep during this broadcast, for which I am eternally grateful. You have a great week, okay?
Absolutely. You too.
All right. That's Laura Bellin. I'm Dennis Hart, and we are indeed out of time. You have been listening to Capital Week on KHOI Community Radio. A reminder that the views and opinions expressed here did not necessarily reflect the opinions of KHOI Radio or its staff. Laura and I will Zoom right back here in this time slot next week with a look at the latest political activity in Iowa and, yes, what it means to all of us. And it does mean a lot. Until then, we thank you so much for the privilege of your time. We appreciate it and we value it. We know you have other things to do. Between now and next time, we hope you have an absolutely positively great week.
And this is Interim Station Manager Mike Murphy breaking in to make the case for supporting community radio. As you may have heard, today is the first day of our fund drive, our on-air appeal for funds to continue to further the mission of KHOI. If you appreciate programs like Capital Week, this program has been on since February. And how important is this program? Such a deep dive into all that goes on in Iowa politics. Dennis and Laura bring a wealth of information to us. They bring a wealth of experience to us, and it's a lot to take in. We air this program live every Monday night. We rebroadcast it on noon on Wednesdays, and we've just started rebroadcasting it during the 6 a.m. hour on Tuesday, so you'll get to hear this again. If you value this kind of programming, I'd ask you to go to khoifm.org and click on that yellow Become a Member Donate button. It's very simple. $60 is an annual membership. $100 is the family membership. Go ahead and do it now. Show your support for Dennis and Laura. Show your support for KHOI. Help us move forward as we move to a new location. KHOI is on the move, and that only happens with your support. So get those fingers in motion, on the move, khoifm.org, become a member /donor button. Do it now while it's fresh on your mind. We really appreciate it. Again, khoifm.org. This is your community radio station. We're asking you to step up and take some ownership. And with that, we're going to switch over to our next half of Capital Week, khoifm.org.